think that microphone is working all right. Begin to find that you will be fine. And perhaps... Well, the other thing I should mention is that we will transcribe this and you will see it and you can have the release on whatever anybody can see.
All right.
Fine. And add whatever you want or eliminate whatever you want at the time.
But, well, fine.
Okay, I guess we're ready to begin then. This is Jim Boning of the Center for History of Chemistry, and I'm speaking with Professor Malcolm Renfrew in New Orleans. Today is the 31st of August, 1987. Dr. Renfrew, you were born on the 12th of October, 1910, Spokane, Washington. Could you tell me something about your family background, your parents?
My parents were young parents. My father was a bookkeeper most of his life, who at that time was working in a bank. My mother was a very delightful woman who is still living, but just barely. She is at 98, has decided she's lived long enough that she can't go on indefinitely and she'd like to get it over with. So I left her, although still alert, not doing well. But in any case, my parents were young and made some of the mistakes parents make on me, but didn't correct all of them when my brother came along. I have a chemist brother, Dr. Edgar E. Renfrew, who also got a PhD in chemistry from the University of Minnesota, and the two of us have had close relationships, and he will be coming out from Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, where he now is a retired research director. He will come out and will be seeing my mother next week. So.
I see. What did your father do?
Well, primarily he was a bookkeeper, and he worked in banks as a teller and bookkeeper, and he became an accountant later on with the almost always in the Inland Empire area, and working. He was an accountant with Potlatch in my high school years, and later on, when he became ill, he was ill just about the time I started college, and my mother became a Hoover postmaster of Potlatch, Idaho, and then during the war years, my father became a traveling accountant for the Weyerhaeuser people who had originally been operated the Potlatch Lumber Company, my father ended his career working in the tax department of the state of Washington.
Now, where did you grow up, in Washington or in Idaho?
Well, both. We moved around in the small towns in the Inland Empire area near Spokane. I graduated from high school in Potlatch, Idaho.
Can you recall anything about your, let's say, your early schooling, with grade school, perhaps, and then leading into high school? Any teachers or anyone who had any specific influence on you?
Yes, most of my teachers did. In Potlatch, we had extraordinarily good teachers. Potlatch was a company town that was operated by a man named A.W. Laird, who was a Laird in practice as well as a name, and he ran a very proper small town in which the school teachers were better paid than elsewhere in Idaho, and they had to toe the morally straight line, but were more competent than most, and I liked essentially all of my teachers.
What were your early interests? Did you have anything specifically that stood out amongst other things that interested you?
My interests normally were in the arts, in music. I became a trombone player at an early age and have continued this. I'm now a member of the Hog Heaven 7, which tries to play Dixieland, and of the Vandal Boosters non-marching pep band, which stands up at football games, and the Pullman Community Band. But anyway, my interests were primarily in the arts. And if your tape will stand it, I can tell you how I became converted to an interest in chemistry, and I became a chemist primarily because I had an uncle who was a chemist. His name was F. Bradley Mackenzie, spelled with an M-A-C. He at one time was the research director for the Carnation Company. He spent his whole life with Carnation. I became a chemist because Bradley was a chemist. The story that I'd like to tell you is why he became a chemist. Well, according to Bradley, he'd been working in the harvest fields and around Pine City, Washington, just before he was due to go to college. And he decided by the time the harvest was over that he didn't want anything to do with farming in his future life. When he got to Washington State College, it's now Washington State University, when he got there, they lined up students for registration, and they were in a large gymnasium area with tables around, and there were signs on the tables where students could go and elect a major. And when he came in, the first table was marked agriculture, and he knew he didn't want that, and the next one was botany, and he was afraid that was some kind of chemistry, and so he... I misspoke on that. He was afraid that botany was some kind of agriculture. He wasn't sure about that. Well, the next one, was there some kind of whistling here?
There's a car down in the hall.
But the next table was chemistry. And he didn't know what chemistry was, but he felt he couldn't go on shilly-shallying around. He'd ought to make up his mind about something, so he went over and stood in that line. And that's how I became a chemist. That's how my brother became a chemist.
Did he talk to you about chemistry? When did you have your first course in chemistry in high school?
No, I had my first course in college. I was better prepared than many students. We had an excellent physics teacher. We had an excellent math teacher, and I took more math than normally was given. And I arrived with biological science and physics in my background, but no chemistry. So I started chemistry at Idaho.
But did Bradley talk to you about chemistry? Did you... seen any of his work?
I suppose somewhat, although I wasn't, he never particularly tried to influence me, but I was a very practical sort, and although my interest really would have been, I think, in becoming a newspaper man, an editor or a writer, I knew that small-town newspaper people didn't do very well financially, and Bradley was considered quite prosperous for young people of the time, and so I, with a practical bent, I thought, well, I'll become a chemist. I never really regretted the choice, although I didn't start working hard at chemistry until I was approaching the end of my college undergraduate degrees, and I would have probably been better prepared all through my later life if I'd have taken fewer English courses and more math courses in college. If your tape permits all these kinds of reminiscences, we had at the University of Idaho at the time I entered a college president who was determined to give young people an education. And he was convinced that students who came to school and had teachers who counted grades as very important, these kinds of students would suffer as far as getting an education was concerned. And so he had come to Potlatch, actually, while I was a senior, and had talked about his plans, how he wanted us to feel that when we came to the university, that if there was something that really interested us that was important, we should look after that instead of preparing for the next day's examination. I took him quite seriously, and the faculty at the university was less sure about him. He had... early on said he wanted the young people to have contacts with the best teachers in the university. He wasn't going to fire any of the others, but he just wanted the best teachers to be the ones students were exposed to. Well, not all members of the faculty were sure they were going to be in the best teacher category, and so he started having a revolt almost from the first day he arrived on campus. So he only lasted 2 or 3 years. He went on to become the head of the Office of Higher Education in the Office of Education. His name was Kelly. I think he probably had a large influence on my life, but in any case, I started trying to become more serious about my math and science courses later on in the year. I wound up with a B average instead of a higher average, but grades I hadn't really felt were too important.
Your selection at the University of Idaho, was that a foregone conclusion, or was that a possibility?
No, it was essentially a foregone conclusion. I lived 20 miles from the University of Idaho, I lived 20 miles from Washington State University, where my favorite uncle had gone, that there were no tuition problems if I went to Idaho, and I had respect for the institution.
Can you tell me something about your first chemistry course at Idaho, since that was the first formal time that you've been exposed to it?
We had as the chemistry professor, the man who was the head of chemistry, was Dr. Carl Leopold Fonenda. He was a native of Iowa, but he'd received his Ph.D. in Germany, and he had was a man of high moral standards and rather rigid standards, and he was a colorful lecturer who really made us do things the way he felt they should be done. But basically, he'd always, I think, had a weakness in math, and he recognized his own weaknesses and was determined that all of us at the University of Idaho would remedy the things that he found deficient in his own approach to science. Actually, all of our problems in chemistry had to be worked with logarithms. And this, some students could never pass chemistry because they could never handle logarithms. And we had very rigid rules in the laboratory. Every note had to be taken in ink in the notebook. If anybody was caught with writing on a scrap of paper, they were tossed out. Our notebooks in which we took the notes on his lectures were collected at the end of every week, and the instructor in our quiz sections had to review these to make sure that we were getting the material the way it should be handled, and then we had quizzes over the material that was given in lectures, and our quantitative experiments had to be done very precisely. Often students who weren't doing well in them would get data from a fraternity brother's notebook of several years past, and Fonenda had made all of the instructors keep precise records of all the vital elements of the quantitative experiments, that the weights of the dishes and so on. So every now and then they would find some poor fellow that they were convinced had not really done the experiment the instructor would. They would go back and dig out the records for past years, and they would find these identical data in the book. Anyway, my freshman year, we learned that chemistry was a precise science. So,
what kind of laboratory experiments did you do?
Studied the preparation of oxygen and determined its gram molecular volume, and the combining weight of lead, and they were good, honest experiments of the time, and the quantitative experiments had to be done properly.
What kind of facilities did Idaho have in chemistry?
We had quite good facilities. Nowadays, when I'm conscious about fume hoods, I wonder how ours really were. But we had fume hoods in the laboratories, and we did our weighing on good analytical balances for the time, and they were good, honest German analytical balances, and the laboratories were well kept, and at the time I entered them were quite new. Since I've become conscious of safety problems with hoods, I remember how we had the hydrogen sulfide supply lines almost out at the front of the hood, and how students used to stand and bubble hydrogen sulfide into the qualitative analysis test tubes, and I've often wondered why we didn't kill more students, but nobody ever complained, to my knowledge. We thought that was the way you took chemistry. Nowadays, Jay Young says we're going to have to go back to H2S because we might get sued if we use thioacetamide. So
I haven't heard Jay say that, but
that's what he's saying. We had a row about it in the union in our meeting today.
How many faculty were there in the chemistry department?
I suppose we had 8 or 9. I don't.
Oh, is that?
I haven't tried to. I'd have to name them over, but I think we had 8 or 9 members.
And were there a large number of chemistry majors?
There were perhaps 10 or 12 each year. Actually, chemistry and chemical engineering at that time were combined. I'm a little fuzzy in my memory as to who were chem engineers and who were chemists. They essentially took the same program. At one time, and in the period in which I was graduating, for some years, ACS ran analyses of the institutions of the country that had turned out the most PhDs based on the undergraduate program, and Idaho ranked second at the time. It was, as I recall, Oberlin was first. I can't remember, but...
Who was chairman of the department?
That was in Fernanda's time. Well, although Fernanda had died, and I think one of the reasons our average went up, a man named Cady took over as chairman, Louis Clyde Cady, and he had was an Idaho student who had taken a master's degree at Idaho, had gone on the faculty, and then went to Wisconsin to take a PhD. And while he was at Wisconsin, he found out what went on in the world, and when he came back, he did a wonderful job of organizing undergraduates to get them into graduate schools. There were no jobs available, you know, and so he would get each one of us to suggest 4 or 5 schools that we would be interested in, and we would get our pick of these, and then he would write letters to get us into those schools. And so we had quite a high percentage of class members going on for graduate work.
You mentioned an interesting point, because the depression occurred, I guess, at the end of your freshman year somewhere. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I entered in the fall of 28, and the depression came on, and it became a real problem to many people.
Did that affect you in terms of staying in school?
No. My parents had been, were determined that my brother and I would get college educations, and so there had been savings accounts set up for us at an early age, and when I graduated from, got my first college degree, I succeeded in getting assistantships, first in physics, and then in chemistry, and they paid around I was supposed to get $500 a year on the first one, but it was reduced to $425 because of the depression. But I could live quite well on $425 for 10 months in Moscow. The way I got the physics assistantship, there were no assistantships in chemistry at the time, but the physics department had one assistant, and it had been offered to a student from the University of Kansas, but the Idaho legislature passed a law that no state jobs could be given to anyone who was not already a resident of the state of Idaho, and the appointment was withdrawn for the young man. Well, there was no physics major who was qualified to be a teaching assistant, and so the head of physics gave me the appointment, and I learned my physics while trying to teach it. I'd had trouble in engineering physics myself, and suddenly I found myself up leading problem solving in engineering physics. And then at the end of the year, then Dr. Fernanda got the felt, well, this teaching assistant business is a way to lower the costs and get more help, and so he started hiring teaching assistants. I spent 2 years as a teaching assistant in chemistry.
What did you take next after your freshman year?
We had a sophomore inorganic course at the time that went again on and deeper into inorganic chemistry, chiefly.
Do you remember any texts you may have used?
There was one by a man, the sophomore text was by Chapin. There's an NSF man who comes to the meetings. I think I've asked him whether he was related to the author of that text, and I think there's a remote connection. I think the text that we had used as a freshman in our freshman course, I think, was a Harry Holmes. I believe it was the text that Holmes wrote, but who had been a young Oberlin instructor. But we really didn't use it very much. Fernanda's lectures were the things that really counted.
As you went proceeded through those last few years then, but was there any area of chemistry that drew your interest more than the others?
No, I our courses were not the equivalent of the modern chemistry courses as taught in a good university. Fernanda taught the physical chemistry course. He again did it with lecturing from notes, and often this involved copying down the analytical data which from the original literature, in which people found that atomic lead had different atomic weights, and we would record the data down. And when we got through with that set of lectures, why, my conclusion was that how could you tell this? These analytical data was kind of give and take here and there, so I wasn't sure that they really found there was a difference. But anyway, and the organic course was taught by a man who had industrial experience, was a very able lecturer, and had all sorts of interesting anecdotes. But his version of organic chemistry was you would take a particular organic group, and you'd lecture 3 weeks on that and have an exam, and then you put that one out of the way and you took up the next one and so on. We did have as a textbook the Norris book, mm-hmm. That kind of did add interest, and later on in life I won the Northeastern Chemistry Section's Norris Award, and I felt that there was poetic justice in this because I had read this book.
Did you do any research as an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate, we had to do a research project. It wouldn't qualify as a research project in many cases. Fernando was my advisor, and he sort of suggested several problems at the beginning of the year, and at the end of the year, I brought my thesis in, and it had to meet the standards of a thesis, but I suspect he never read it, but it was...
Now, did he assign you as an advisee, or did you select him?
Oh, it was... We had some element of selection among the department, but it kind of amounted that every department man had to have so many appointees, and so that... Fernanda, he drilled us, and we had to do writing of a thesis. We had to do a long-term paper in which we had to go to the literature and really... in some ways, it was a fine education headed up by a man who had deficiencies in his own chemical training. And so I've always been sympathetic to the people who aren't Nobel Prize winners who are teaching chemistry and really are doing the right thing by students.
As you were approaching the end of those 4 years as an undergraduate, had you... Again, the times certainly hadn't improved much from 1929. Had you given any thought as to what you were going to do when you finished your undergraduate degree?
Well, as I say, I there was essentially no place to go for a job. I got the physics assistantship, and then I had 2 years in chemistry on teaching assistantships, and then I had to really do something. But that was Katie. Then got us into graduate school, and I got the appointment at Minnesota. I had an offer from Stanford and one from Minnesota, but the one from Minnesota came in first, and so I took it first. Actually, I had an alternative consideration. I'd taken a few education courses along with my master's program, and I toyed with the thought of teaching in high school, but the only two jobs that I really could have had, at least in that sort of were thrust upon me, was one in Fairbanks, Alaska. I would have had to be the coach for a tumbling team. I didn't think I could do that. I had an offer of a job in Kimberley, Idaho, but I would have to get married before I came. So that I didn't have that prospect. So I went to Minnesota. The teaching assistantship at Minnesota paid $300 a year. It was called a half-time, a quarter-time teaching assistantship, I think it was. And Minnesota split these up, and so I went to Minnesota with that appointment. And
that was less than what you were getting in Idaho.
At Idaho. But technically, I was supposed to do only half as much work as I did at Idaho. But when we got there, it turned out that Minnesota had an unusually large enrollment that fall of undergraduates, and they had to have extra teaching assistantships. So those of us who had these $300 appointments, our working time was doubled, and our pay was increased to $450. So some teaching assistants got $600 and some of us got $450. The same loads.
I just want to come back for a moment to your master's degree. You had a paper on nickel sulfide. Was that part of your master's
degree? Yeah, that was my master's thesis. I've been trying to get Janine Shreve to look at the current status of nickel sulfide, and I felt that I would rewrite my master's thesis. Another fellow who's a master's candidate and I participated in this paper with W.H. Cohn, and Cohn had the theory that the inside, the nickel sulfide anomaly, you know, you can't precipitate nickel sulfide in an acidic solution, but once you get it precipitated, then it won't dissolve in the solution. So Cohn felt that adsorbed sulfide ions were there in sufficient quantity that you could not exceed the solubility product, and so, and we did quite a few ingenious experiments, I think, to prove his theory. When the paper was presented with this as the explanation, the referees would not tolerate the explanation. They felt we hadn't shown the hydrosulfide ion content, and there was no mention of activities, coefficients, and so on, and so they wouldn't accept this. So, to my knowledge, the explanation for the nickel sulfide insolubility is still the formation of isomeric forms or something. And I haven't really come back in recent years. When I came back to Idaho, I thought, by George, I would do a little and take some other work that Cohn had done and pull this together as another paper, take a crack at it. You've reminded me, I'm going to go back and ask Janine if she's done anything with this, because I told her that I didn't feel that I was up to modern inorganic chemistry, but if I had an associate who would tell me what things are done, it might make a paper.
Now, why did you stay on for the master's degree at Idaho?
There really wasn't anything else to do.
Okay, and there wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then Katie didn't work on moving students into other graduate schools until. Or was he already doing that when you went into your master's program?
Well, no, he did that. He came into the after the master's program I'd started in the master program.
All right.
Fernanda died, I think, actually early in my last year Idaho.
How many other students that you graduated with from Idaho went on to other graduate schools? And do you remember some of the other graduate schools they went to?
There was. One of the fellows that I roomed with went to Northwestern, and one went to the University of Illinois, and one had gone to Columbia. I think there were four or five of us who went on to graduate school at that time. That was about half of us went on to graduate school.